For those who have known me for any significant period of time, you know that I am not a very quiet person. What? That's crazy, Jacob says in the loudest voice possible. It's hilarious because I remember years ago, one of our neighbors, Ellie Candelaria, she came across the street and she was coming over for a visit for something. And it was hilarious because she walked in, she visited, she talked. And then as she's getting ready to leave, she looks at Heather and I and she says, "Are you guys always this loud?" Yes, we are. One of my favorite memories, and it's not just me, it's my whole extended family as well. Now, I'll give it up for my sister, Denise, who is deaf right now. She obviously can't gauge loudness and softness based on what she's talking. I remember years ago, we were at a Good Friday service at this church, and she was there. And you know, what do you do at the end of a Good Friday service? You're supposed to, like, you hear the strepitus, everyone gets scared, and then you walk out, and it's really quiet, and it's really subdued, and so we start walking out, and my sister who's deaf doesn't know that everyone's really being quiet, and as we're walking out, I forgot what she said, but she probably said something to the tune of, "Oh, wow, that was a great service," at the top of her lungs. It's just fantastic. I know Mark Thomas does this every time we have communion. He is back there, and again, sometimes it's quiet. He's talking while he's taking communion. We're just allowed. We have a hard time in the Manning family of staying quiet. Now, I know there's times and places when being quiet is important. But I also know that there's times when maybe it is important for us to speak up, not just in our volume, but in what we actually say. We're going to see Paul is now moving out of Athens. And as he moves out of Athens, he moves to this area that Heather and I were really wanting to go to when we were in Greece a couple of years ago, but we never did, to a city called Corinth. And in that city, it was kind of a giant mess. Athens was the intellectual place. This is where all of the great thinkers, philosophizers, this is where all the academics would hang out. Corinth was much more akin to a New Orleans or a Las Vegas. It was a party capital. If you were labeled as a Corinthian, you were known for all of your sexual activities. Whenever someone was going to portray a Corinthian in a play, they were always portrayed drunk. It just became synonymous with sinning. And so Paul is now leaving Athens, intellectual place, and he's going into Corinth, and you got to think to yourself, how do I enter into this town? Because here's Paul. He's got a lot of baggage. He's got a lot of sin in his past. But should he be speaking up? Should he be saying anything as he enters into this town? He got some headway in Athens, but now a totally different scenario. People are, it's a much bigger city. It's a lot more people, and he doesn't know exactly what to do. But it's interesting that God gives some very important advice to him of what he should do specifically. And this is where I think what we learn from it is trying to find out from God, when do we speak up and when do we remain silent? This is one of the hardest things to do as a Christian, especially when it comes to sharing faith, when it comes to the pointing out of sin, when do we speak up and when do we remain silent? Paul probably has some major PTSD along with it, that if you remember, he's for several cities, he's been essentially chased out of town. In some places, he's been beaten, he's been stoned, he's been left for dead. And so now he's coming into another place. It's a lot bigger. There's a lot more sin. And the question is, should I point out the sin or not? Because if I start pointing out people's sin, most often people don't take that well. Anyone here like it when sin is pointed out in your life? Does anyone enjoy that? Is anyone like, "Hey, you really do cuss a lot. Hey, your life is a total disaster and you're making some really poor choices in your life. Hey, you really shouldn't speak to your mom that way. Hey," no one likes it when our sin is pointed out. So Paul is going to have to make some decisions of how he's going to live. And it's great because God gives some specific instruction of what to do. All right, so here we are in Corinth. And it's also a very interesting thing, one more point. In all of the other places he's been, his ministry has lasted maybe a couple of weeks, right? Corinth, everything changes, which is kind of strange when you think about it, that he's in this place of total hedonism, total debauchery, total sinfulness everywhere he turns. He ends up making this, if I remember my research correctly, this is the second longest place he ends up. Let's see if we find out how long he ends up here in Corinth. So after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife, Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. So he meets these two people, Priscilla and Aquila, and they become very influential within the church. And it's very interesting because even now when I say their names, I usually end up saying their names the way that they are often presented. Priscilla and Aquila. Did you notice who I put first? I put the female first. This is one of the few places Aquila is actually mentioned first, probably because as Luke is writing this, he's trying to just keep it set and, you know, let's mention the guy first, Aquila, and his wife Priscilla. But almost all the times after this, it's Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla is one of those people who's very influential, which I think is one of the most crucial things when it comes to doing ministry, which is why, again, women tend to be the drivers of spirituality, and it is much more effective when the husband and the wife are on the same page in driving that bus together. They've done studies on what that means for their kids, that if the man is leading, it's somewhere about 8% of the times the kids will become Christian. If it's the mom who is the only one doing it, it's more like 25%. But if the husband and the wife are in this team-type ministry, especially when it comes to their kids and raising them and leading them, the numbers jump to like 87%. It's amazing to think about. So this is a reminder, again, with Priscilla and Aquila. They're in this team ministry, and I just encourage all of you to always be in team ministry if you are in a married relationship. And, of course, for anyone who is not in a relationship, you're looking for someone who will become a partner with you in the ministry. Super important. But they're in Corinth because Claudius had kicked all the people out of Rome, which is one of those great things where something bad was happening. They all got kicked out. But then it caused the kingdom of God to spread. Very fascinating. So Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker as they were, he stayed and worked with them. So Paul is doing what we would call a dual ministry. He would be a worker priest, which again is very, it's actually something that's making a comeback nowadays where people serve in the leadership of the church, but they have a full-time job elsewhere, and they gain their money that way, they gain their livelihood, and then they do the ministry. But this, Paul ends up with these tent makers, Priscilla and Aquila, and because they had the same knowledge, they had the same background, he would work with them. And then verse 4, every Sabbath, he reasoned in the synagogues, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. So he would go, he would work as a tent maker, he would come to the synagogue, and he would talk to them and say, hey, we really need to talk about this, and we really need to see if we can do something with you in your life. So while Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, Your blood be on your own heads. I'm clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. This becomes one of the major shifts in Paul's ministry. Paul had been originally really set on making sure that he's preaching to Jews, going to the synagogues first. And now as he does this and continues to experience heartache and pain and abuse, he now gets to the point where, look, the time and energy that I have to spend, he still does go to Jewish people, as we will see as Acts unfolds, but he starts turning his attention more to those who did not have a background inside religion. And he shakes off his clothes, akin to when Jesus said, when you go somewhere and if they reject you, you know, just kind of kick the dust off your feet and don't let that affect. The idea behind that is not just, hey, you know, I'm ditching you guys, but more especially for the worker, that there are going to be times that you fail. Period. You will not evangelize everyone you come in contact with. I remember years ago, I never did pick up the video game, but I was really tempted to pick it up. But years ago, I remember even talking about this. I think Bob Kessler. Bob, did you pick up this video game? I think you might have. It was a video game that was all about evangelism. And so it was like you were this person and you would go up to people and you would talk. And the idea in the game was you would evangelize people. And you know how you would evangelize someone? All you would have to do is go up to them and stand next to them for a little while. And soon they would turn from, I don't know, like black, like in the shadows or something like that, to now. They're evangelized. They have the light of Jesus in their life. And I was like, man, if that's all it takes to evangelize, that'd be fantastic. And in this game, I believe you could never fail. Like every person you ran into, you could actually evangelize. Now, if you could evangelize and have people turn to Jesus because of your testifying to them every single time, you are better than Jesus. Did every person that Jesus come in contact with, did they turn and believe? No, there were tons of people. My goodness, he even failed on one of his inner disciples, right? Judas? This guy couldn't even, his heart was so far gone, but God never gave up on people, but Jesus did not get every single person. And so sometimes it's important for us that we shake the dust off. But also, did you hear the words he said? May your blood be on your own hands, on your own heads. Again, very similar to the time when Jesus being crucified and Pilate was pleading with them. They eventually said, look, we want him dead and we'll take the fall. It's our fault this man dies. His blood will be on us and on our children. We have lost a little bit within our culture the idea of personal responsibility. Especially when it comes to sin, I believe that there are times when it is appropriate to talk about and understand the workings of Satan and how he attacks and how he tempts. But I worry that we are just simply not paying attention to the fact that our choices have consequences. That when we choose to live in certain ways, it may not affect us right then and there in the moment, but it could have an effect that cumulatively builds up until everything in your life starts falling apart and you wonder, how did I get into this mess? I think that we fail to understand personal responsibility because we don't have immediate consequences to our actions. I believe that sometimes we don't think about our personal responsibility because we just simply cover everything with God's grace and forgiveness. I was just talking with a pastor friend of mine. We were chit-chatting about this very thing. And he was talking about how he was ministering to someone who was in a relationship with his girlfriend, and he was clearly doing things that were outside the normal boundaries of a healthy Christian relationship. And he would ask him, and he would say, I mean, do you understand that what you're doing is not what God really wants for your life? And the guy would always answer the same way. He would say, no, I've asked for forgiveness. Nope, I've asked for forgiveness. But wait, what are you going to do tonight? I've already asked for forgiveness. I've already asked for forgiveness. I've already asked for forgiveness. And I think that because that becomes something that we think about, we say without even thinking about it, we forget to realize that those things can have earthly consequences. We may not suffer an eternal consequence because of the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, but we may end up suffering with earthly consequences that can absolutely wreck our lives. And I think that we as Christians sometimes shy away from saying things like this because we're worried that it's going to hurt a relationship. Maybe people won't like us as much. I admit, even as a pastor, sometimes it's difficult to preach about sin, especially acceptable sins that society has accepted. But what you're going to see with Paul's ability to call out sin and to not remain silent, he starts having an effect on some of the strangest people. I kind of chuckle as I read through this because I feel bad for the synagogue. The Jewish synagogue that Paul is at and he's doing this, this poor synagogue is going to lose, in a very short amount of time, their two leaders. That's exactly what happens. Take a look at the next verse. He says, then Paul left the synagogue and went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. I just love that this dude owns a house that's literally right next door to the synagogue. But check out who shows up. A guy named Crispus, which sounds like a cracker. I don't know. What do you think? Crispus? Crispus? Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his entire household believed in the Lord, and many of the Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. He converts the synagogue ruler and his whole household. Sometimes it's important for us to speak up on sin even when we feel uncomfortable. When I was on my vicarage, I was very thankful to my vicarage supervisor, Pastor Kevin Wiesman. He allowed me to preach a lot on my vicarage, and by doing that, I think I got a lot of bad sermons out of my system, because, you know, you have to. You got to get some of like, ooh, this is a great idea, and it's my idea, and it's really not driven from the Bible, so you got to get those out. But I remember one Sunday, I decided to preach a sermon that was very much calling out of sin. Now, I'm going to admit that I don't know if I did it very well, because I think sometimes when we call out sin, we do it in such a way that keeps us in a judgmental, superior position over someone else. And also, I think I did this because I was hurt. I was hurt because of the activities that had happened the day before. The day before I was supposed to preach, we were going to do some door-to-door evangelism. Now, door-to-door evangelism is really hard. It's really hard. But sometimes it does work, and I'm amazed when it does. And we were also going to call on people who had visited the church, and we were going to go and just say hi and check in on them and see how things were going. And I had seen actually first.